Today is Thursday, September 10th, and this is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, newly released tapes show U.S. President Donald Trump knew about COVID-19's risks months ago, but minimized them.
I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down because I don't want to create a panic.
Also ahead, deadly protests in Colombia against a police killing. Plus, the latest from the Charlie Hebdo trial in France. These stories and more are next. Our top story today, newly released tapes recorded in February show that U.S. President Donald Trump knew at the time how deadly and contagious the new coronavirus is, but publicly downplayed the risks to the American people. Trump was recorded speaking to Washington Post journalist Bob Woodward at the time, who included the revelations in his new book titled Rage. Here's Trump speaking with Woodward.
I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down.
Yes, sir.
Because I don't want to create a panic.
COVID-19 has killed over 190,000 people in the U.S. with over 6.2 million infections, the largest death toll and caseload of any country. A White House spokesperson on Wednesday denied Trump intentionally misled Americans about the virus and said he was remaining calm and resolute in a crisis. Trump has been accused of reacting slowly and not taking the disease seriously. In late February, nearly 3 weeks after speaking with Woodward, Trump told journalists that COVID-19 was not as severe, saying, quote, "It's a little like the regular flu that we have flu shots for," end quote. But the newly released tapes show that Trump knew the virus was especially deadly.
It goes through air, Bob. That's always tougher than the touch. You know, the touch, you don't have to touch things, right? But the air, you just breathe the air, and that's how it's passed. And so that's a very tricky one. That's a very delicate one. It's also more deadly than your strenuous flus.
Trump's rival in this year's presidential race, Democratic candidate Joe Biden, responded to Trump's February comments.
On the day that we hit 190,000 dead in the United States because of COVID-19, we just learned from the Washington Post columnist Bob Woodward that the President of the United States has admitted on tape in February he knew about COVID-19, that it passed through the air. He knew how deadly it was. It was much more deadly than the flu. He knew and purposely played it down. Worse, he lied to the American people. He knowingly and willingly lied about the threat it posed to the country for months. He had the information. He knew how dangerous it was. And while this deadly disease ripped through our nation, he failed to do his job on purpose. It was a life and death betrayal of the American people.
Democratic lawmakers also slammed the president's actions. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer of New York.
There is damning proof that Donald Trump lied and people died. This report is totally believable. We all know President Trump puts himself first. But this time, the consequences were deadly. And when I think about how many people in my state died in February, in March, in April, it just makes me angry. I cannot believe he deceived the American people the way he did. How many people would still be alive today if he just told Americans the truth?
Senate Republicans had different reactions. Here's Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell responding to a reporter's question.
Was the president lying to the American people who then died because their president was downplaying a threat to them?
Look, I didn't look at the Woodward book. I will later, but I haven't even seen what you're referring to yet. Clearly, that's a question for the White House anyway. It's a question for the White House.
And Texas Senator Ted Cruz.
Could you respond to the allegations reported in Bob Woodward's book, The President on Tape?
I haven't read the book.
Louisiana Senator Bill Casey responds to another reporter's question about the book.
I have not. This is the first I've heard of that. So I'm not. The bombshell hadn't hit me yet.
I can read you the excerpt and you can respond to it.
I'll read it first. I always like to kind of have, you know, my firsthand kind of impression of it.
Globally, the World Health Organization reports over 27.6 million COVID-19 cases with nearly 900,000 deaths. Washington Post journalist Bob Woodward's book has also shined more light on the unlikely relationship between U.S. President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. The book will not be released until next week, but the U.S. cable news network CNN and the Washington Post have published excerpts. VOA's Bill Gallo in Seoul has the details.
For his new book, entitled Rage, journalist Bob Woodward had access to 25 letters exchanged between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. It is an unprecedented behind-the-scenes look at one of the most unexpected diplomatic relationships in world history. In the letters, Kim showers Trump with praise, repeatedly addressing him as Your Excellency and hailing their deep and special friendship. After their first meeting in Singapore in June 2018, Kim reportedly reminisced about holding Trump's hand. Kim called their second meeting in Hanoi a moment of glory that remains a precious memory. Trump returned the praise, calling Kim far beyond smart. According to the Washington Post, Trump boasted to Woodward that Kim tells me everything, including a graphic description of how he killed his uncle in 2013. The letters are grabbing headlines, but they may hurt the prospect of nuclear talks, said veteran Korea observer Mark Berry.
To have any excerpts of it published either in his book or as occurred today on CNN, you know, that's privileged diplomatic communications.
The matter is also tricky, Berry said, since Kim's words are typically treated with the utmost respect in authoritarian North Korea.
You don't misuse the great leader's words in a callous way. I mean, the worst that can happen is that internally, Kim could appear to be a supplicant to Trump.
North Korea has not responded to the release of the correspondence. But it may not be too surprised, since Trump previously tweeted out one of Kim's letters in July 2018. Trump and Kim didn't always get along. In 2017, the two regularly exchanged insults, with Trump calling Kim Little Rocket Man and Kim slamming Trump as a mentally deranged U.S. dotard. At one point, Trump threatened to totally destroy North Korea. The tensions dissipated after Trump became the first sitting U.S. president to meet a North Korean leader. Trump later claimed the two fell in love. The relationship has held firm, even after North Korea last year resumed short-range ballistic missile tests and walked away from nuclear negotiations. If he wins re-election in November, Trump has said he will reach a deal very quickly with Kim. Trump's opponent, former Vice President Joe Biden, has said he will not continue Trump's personal outreach to Kim, signaling a return to a more traditional U.S. posture. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul.
An official at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security said in a whistleblower complaint released Wednesday that he was pressured by more senior officials to suppress facts in intelligence reports that President Donald Trump might find objectionable. They included information about Russian interference in the election and the rising threat posed by white supremacists. International Edition's Lori London spoke to VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden for details on the allegations.
This is a complaint that was filed earlier this week by Brian Murphy, who had been the Department of Homeland Security's principal deputy undersecretary in the Office of Intelligence and Analysis. So he's a senior official involved in just about all aspects of the intelligence operations for the Department of Homeland Security, a key advisor to the Secretary of Homeland Security. And he held that position for a couple of years. So there during Trump's second Homeland Security Secretary, Kristen Nielsen, and the current acting Secretary of Homeland Security, Chad Wolf. And he says there are several incidents over the past couple of years during which he was told by superiors, including the former Secretary of Homeland Security and the acting Secretary of Homeland Security, to alter his intelligence analysis so it would better mirror the narrative that was coming from the White House. And he said he refused to do that. And as a result, he was demoted. And instead of being in charge of intelligence analysis, he became the Assistant Deputy Undersecretary for Management.
What are the implications in this narrative?
The implications, if this is true, are significant because it would mean that senior Trump administration officials, including in the Department of Homeland Security and in the White House, purposefully were telling officials, intelligence officials, to change their analysis, to change their assessments of the security situation to match the policies that the Trump administration wanted to push. For example, Murphy alleges that in November of 2018 and in May of 2019, he was asked by senior Homeland Security officials to change his analysis about how many terrorists, known or suspected terrorists, were coming into the country across the border with Mexico. And he said, according to his complaint, there were only three, and these three known or suspected terrorists really only had contacts. They had phone numbers of people who were known to be in touch with actual terrorists. But he says the Department of Homeland Security and then Homeland Security Secretary Nielsen testified there were almost 4,000 known or suspected terrorists crossing the southern border. Back during that time period, VOA reported that counterterrorism officials, not with the Department of Homeland Security, said there was no evidence to suggest either terrorists affiliated with the Islamic State or Al-Qaeda were trying to cross the border. But DHS continued with that narrative supported by the White House. Another allegation, Murphy said that in mid-May of this year and also in July of this year, he was told to stop disseminating or sharing any intelligence regarding Russian activities, Russian disinformation efforts with the upcoming presidential election. In fact, he says he was told by the acting Homeland Security Secretary to focus on providing intelligence about what China and Iran are doing to influence the outcome of elections. He said he refused because that would mean to put the U.S. in a perilous position because the intelligence, he says, indicated that Russia was doing stuff and it's information that the president needed to know. So these are the types of things he says have happened. He also said that there was an attempt by Ken Cuccinelli, another top Homeland Security official, to have him focus more on Antifa as opposed to white nationalists, again, to match the narrative, the rhetoric that was coming from the White House.
Jeff, it's interesting that Mr. Murphy, that his name is out in the open, that he wasn't trying to hide it. A lot of these whistleblowers try to stay anonymous. So what happens next here?
It's interesting. According to the complaint, Murphy these grievances with the Office of Inspector General, but today it was released by the House Intelligence Committee and its chairman, Representative Adam Schiff, who's now asking to come and testify later this month for a deposition before the House Intelligence Committee.
That was VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden speaking to my colleague Lori London. A spokesman for the Department of Homeland Security has denied Mr. Murphy's claims. This is VOA. South Africans are mourning the death of anti-apartheid activist and attorney George Bezos, who served as defense lawyer for South African icon Nelson Mandela. Bezos' family said Thursday that the Greek-born lawyer, who came to South Africa as a refugee during World War II, died of natural causes late Wednesday. He was 92. President Cyril Ramaphosa described Bezos as, quote, the legal eagle of our country, end quote. Bezos defended Mandela and others in the so-called Rivonia trial of the 1960s. The defendants all were sentenced to long prison terms for their roles in fighting the racist apartheid system. After Mandela was released from prison and elected the nation's first black president, Bezos helped craft one of the world's most progressive constitutions. A new report by the World Wildlife Fund, or WWF, says wildlife population sizes have decreased on average by 68% in the last 50 years. The WWF's Living Planet Index says the largest decline has taken place in the tropical subregions of North and South America, with wildlife populations declining there by 94%. The group said this matters because wildlife is, quote, fundamental to human life on Earth, and the evidence is unequivocal. It is being destroyed by us at a rate unprecedented in history, end quote. The group warns that climate change is further accelerating the decline of wild animal populations, and that loss of biodiversity threatens human food security. The WWF said that human economic and food production systems must be transformed to, quote, protect human health, wealth, and security, end quote. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Colombia's defense ministry said Thursday that 7 civilians were killed during protests in the capital Bogota Wednesday night. The demonstrations were in response to the death of a lawyer in police custody. For more, I spoke to journalist Megan Janetsky in Colombia's second city of Medellin.
This man's name is Javier Ordóñez. He's a Colombian father of two. He's a lawyer in the country's capital of Bogota. And he was out drinking in the street and violating social distancing rules. And there's this video of police essentially with their knees on his back, shocking him with tasers as he's begging for them to stop, saying, please, no more. And after this ordeal, he ended up dying in the hospital, and it created, you know, a lot of anger in the Colombian public.
Yeah, and can you talk about that? What happened during the protests?
So last night, hundreds of protesters in Bogota mainly, but in other parts of the country too, they came out and were clashing with police. They gathered outside the police station where the man was held. And they were essentially throwing trash cans, rocks, and stick, battering windows. One police car was burned. Two police stations were torched, and three others were heavily damaged. And the Ministry of Defense just confirmed that 7 people were killed and almost 150 people were wounded in these clashes.
And what was the police response to the protests like?
Based on the photos we saw this morning, there was a lot of tear gas. It was definitely a forceful response. To give you an idea of the kind of force that was used by the Colombian state, there were 1,600 either federal agents or police officers congregated in Bogota, and more than half of them came from other parts of the country. So there was a really, really strong response by authorities.
Last of all, there's a lot of violence in Colombia with the different armed groups there, but are police killings in Colombia also common?
No, usually police killings aren't massive. Here, I think the most memorable one we've seen is at the end of last year, there were mass protests against the government, and riot police killed an 18-year-old boy named Dylan Cruz. And that was a really, really big thing because he was kind of turned into the symbol of this protest movement that was taking hold of Colombia at the end of last year. But generally, no, I think there's something to be said about these protests kind of tethering to this wave of protests in the United States, but also I think it's something more than that. I think it's kind of a breaking point for this buildup of anger and frustration against the Colombian state that we've already seen, especially during COVID.
That was journalist Megan Janetsky in Medellin, Colombia, speaking to me earlier. The trial of those accused of assisting in the deadly rampage at the Charlie Hebdo magazine in Paris in 2015 has entered its second week as survivors took the stand to testify. The 3 gunmen are dead, but 14 other people are accused of being their accomplices. For more, I spoke to journalist Catherine Field in Paris.
The trial's taking place in a specially constructed courtroom in the north of Paris. There are 14 alleged accomplices who are on trial. 3 are being tried in absentia. Those 3 are believed to have traveled to Syria in the days just preceding the attack. We're looking at having in total 144 witnesses. There's going to be 14 expert witnesses and, of course, 200 victims. The trial is expected to last until early November, and we're looking at a verdict for those 14 accused to be handed down on the 10th of November.
And so what have these testimonies been like?
It's been a very difficult time for the families. Right from day one, when the presiding judge read out the names of the 17 who died during those 3 days of attacks, on that first day, some wept, some had to leave. And it's really only been in the last couple of days that we've had firsthand evidence from the victims and from the families of those who died. It's been absolutely harrowing. We had on Wednesday one of the witnesses who was leaving Charlie Hebdo offices that day walked into the gunman. They forced her back into the building, forced her to tap in the passcode to get into the building. And they forced her into the room where she watched for 1.5 minutes as they gunned down her colleagues. She just found it so difficult in court. She kept breaking down, kept apologizing. She said that her life was absolutely just a trial ever since then. There was another witness who said she was also pushed back into the room by the gunman. She kept thinking about her young daughter because she was meant to be picking up her daughter then. All these types of testimonies, we're going to be hearing that now for the next 3 weeks. Absolutely harrowing, absolutely difficult for the families and for the victims as well.
Now, you've mentioned some 200 victims, and that number is so high because the attacks were not just at the offices of the Charlie Hebdo magazine. Is that correct?
That's right. There was, in fact, that first attack at Charlie Hebdo, which was on the Wednesday, 7th of January, 2015. The next day, there was an attack on a municipal police officer in the south of Paris. And then on the Friday, there was the attack on the kosher supermarket in the east of Paris. And there we're going to be hearing some really just, it's going to be chilling testimony. Families who were then hid for 4 hours in the cold store at that supermarket to get away from the gunman. We've got also other young witnesses who said that they were just hiding behind shelves in that kosher supermarket. We're going to hear a witness who just dropped in there because she was on her way to see her granny. It was Friday. She wanted to take a special gift to her granny, her Jewish granny. On that day, she was in the supermarket when the gunman burst in. So we've still got that coming down the road.
That was journalist Catherine Field in Paris speaking to me earlier. The United States has sanctioned two former Lebanese government ministers for allegedly providing material support to Hezbollah and engaging in corruption. The U.S. is providing Lebanon with humanitarian assistance following the August Beirut explosion, but is calling for government reforms. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi has the details.
The United States stopped short of sanctioning any current government ministers or some of the prominent Lebanese officials who have been denounced in the aftermath of the Beirut explosion. But U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said that two former ministers had directed political and economic favors to Hezbollah, including ensuring Hezbollah-owned companies won government contracts worth millions of dollars and moving money from government ministries to Hezbollah-associated institutions. The two are Yusef Finianos, who was Minister of Transportation and Public Works, and Ali Hassan Khalil, who was Minister of Finance from 2014 until earlier this year. The U.S. has designated Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, although it has broad political and economic reach in Lebanon. The Trump administration said the action is intended to help Lebanon to overhaul its political system. David Schenker is the U.S. Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs. He said at an online event this week that the United States is seeking substantial change in Lebanon and will not support just cosmetic reform.
Reform, anti-corruption, transparency, accountability, all those would be unprecedented for Lebanon, right? That would be transformative in a way. But I think it would be substantial. And I think that does constitute real change. We have to continue to hold a high standard of benchmarks for what actually constitutes reform.
Last week, Schenker was in Beirut to observe recovery efforts from last month's massive chemical explosion, which killed nearly 200 people and injured more than 6,000. He met with opposition figures and said the United States supports the Lebanese people's call for reform and will use all available authorities to promote accountability for Lebanese leaders who have failed their people.
I carried a message to the Lebanese people that we're committed to helping them recover from the horrific August 4th explosion. We provided more than $18 million in humanitarian assistance on that front so far and are preparing to provide an additional $30 million to support efforts to recover from this disaster.
Since the blast, thousands of people have protested nearly daily in Beirut demanding reforms. The government resigned a week after the blast, but a new government has not yet taken office. Schenker said he told the Lebanese that the United States is supporting them to end corruption and mismanagement. He is stressing the need to implement all necessary reforms to bring Lebanon back from its devastating economic crisis. Mohammed El-Shenawy, VOA News, Washington.
That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and the entire International Edition team, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.